This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Say yes to Pure Leaf tea and free gas for a year only at True North Convenience Stores. When it comes to quality, say yes to the delicious taste of real brewed Pure Leaf tea. True North stores are stocked with your favorite flavors like unsweetened, extra sweet, and raspberry. For a limited time, enter for a chance to win free gas for a year. Check the True Rewards app for details or download the mobile app from the Apple or Google Play stores. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
What is Dax, are you?
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all, so we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Good morning, folks. We started out this week with a monologue that I did on the rise and fall of the Napa Valley of cannabis is what they thought they were going to be in Pueblo, Colorado. It was a Wall Street Journal article, very well done, talked about this industry from a bunch of different perspectives, limited to Pueblo County and the city of Pueblo, Colorado, just south of Colorado Springs. And we followed that up with a conversation with one of the ladies whose son ended up getting addicted to it and moved on to other drugs and has had significant challenges in her view of what she saw going on in Pueblo with the marijuana legalization industry and what it's left behind in Pueblo. And the picture that was painted by most of these folks is that it was fairly abysmal. Kevin Caldwell joins us from the Southeast Legislative Group. He's the manager there, the Marijuana Policy Project. They have been advocates for legalization of marijuana, and Kevin's been on the show many times relative to this discussion, and we're happy to have him on again. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me back again, Noel. I appreciate it. Always welcome the opportunity.
Yes. So, Kevin, I know I think you have some observations, actually, about this Wall Street Journal article and some other things. So I'll give you the floor.
Sure. Thank you very much. Listen, I, on your first episode where you went over the Wall Street Journal article, one of the things that I heard you say was, when I saw on the horizon was an industry that made it glaringly easy to duck taxes, avoid red tape, and dodge quality control. There was little to no planning to enforce or monitor these companies, and it was merely a ploy for easy and fast tax dollars, and they got them for a time. Then shortly thereafter, you followed up with, those black market dealers, unlike licensed ones, face neither taxes nor red tape. I kind of find these statements rather contradictory. The reason for the decline in the legal market is precisely because of the factors such as high taxes, red tape, and strict regulations.
You're misstating what I said. There's no doubt that the illicit market is created and is successful because they've done a hell of a job in taxing the product. And I even talked about all of the taxes on the product in Pueblo and in Colorado.
Well, you know, like let's look at Pueblo, for example. In general, Colorado has a 6% sales tax, okay? The state of Colorado levies a 15% marijuana sales tax, as well as an additional 15% excise tax. Pueblo County taxes on another 5% excise tax, and the city of Pueblo pays an additional 10% excise tax. So that's 51% in total. So if a consumer went into a shop, bought $100 worth of cannabis products, they're going to walk out with $151. So yes, I will agree that is way too much taxation. And but, you know, at the same time, yes, there was a point where there were people in the industry who were promoting that this was going to be a panacea for, you know, for all the state's needs. Listen, there's no state that gets more than, you know, even a percent of what their annual budget is off of cannabis taxes. What I will say, though, is that, for example, since Colorado did that, and it's the first state to open up adult sales, they've made $2.6 billion in tax revenue. That was as of January 2024. And they are currently supporting 30,000 jobs. Those numbers are from the Colorado Department of Revenue. Last year, in 2024, within Pueblo, Colorado, they sold, I'm sorry, within the city of Pueblo, they sold $5 million worth of cannabis products. That's $500,000 that went right into the coffers of the city of Pueblo. There was recently, there were two polls, one from the Public Policy Polling, which maybe has a slightly left of center tint to it, and one from a slightly righter wing, I should say, polling. That's the Colorado statewide poll. And in that poll, 67% of Coloradans thought that legalization was a success, with 21% in opposition. And then the public policy polling found 71% thought that it was a success, with 23% saying that it should still be prohibited. So I think that we can look to say that a vast majority of Coloradans view legalization as a success. And one must remember that 55% of people passed the amendment that legalized cannabis in 2012. So
let me ask you a question
right there.
Sure.
Not all counties in Colorado passed legalization, correct?
Well, no, sir. They did not allow for cannabis businesses to operate within the county line.
And how many of the counties in Colorado? What percentage of the counties in Colorado actually allow the legal dispensing of marijuana?
You know, I would have to get back to you on that. I believe it's about 40% allow it.
I think 60% probably disallow it, correct? That's correct. And, you know, the when I look at some of these surveys, and I've looked at them long and hard, a lot of them, in my view, are kind of fundamentally flaws to the sampling of where you know, certain things are. When you ask a question in a way and people answer it and they say, oh, no, it hadn't been that detrimental. Well, maybe they live in a county that it's not approved, so they don't see the downside implications of these things. You know, and
well,
I know that there's that rule
with the fact that people in those counties can still consume cannabis. They can still grow their own cannabis. They just don't allow the commercial sales of the product. So that's
correct. And a lot of what was going on in Pueblo was the downturn in the industry, the lack of financing, big groups dumping product on the market, driving the price down. They're not able to collect as much taxes. And what you have is an abandonment period right now, that where you have buildings that were jacked up in pricing as a result of everyone thinking that this was going to be the place to be, the Golden Circle, and it turned out that it wasn't. And, you know, it's a science experiment that maybe works a little better somewhere else, but it didn't work in Pueblo. But what has been consistent throughout the country is the rise in illicit marijuana. Now, I don't know where the delicate balance tax number is relative to legal versus illicit. But I also am not aware of a single jurisdiction that has legalized marijuana that would raise their right hand and said that there's not been an increase in illicit sales. And in fact, the most recent survey says 70% of the marijuana in this country is illicit marijuana, not legal marijuana.
Well, and I mean, Mike.
So we've created a problem with this industry that most people never in their wildest dreams, and Kevin, you would admit to this, no one thought the illicit industry was going to be as prevalent as it was. In fact, this was going to be an opportunity to drive down the illicit industry, is what we were told. Those in law enforcement never believed it, and no one would listen to us when we sang from the tops of mountains that that's not how this is going to work. And so we were not surprised at all that the illicit side of this industry is alive and well. We don't do DNA on these plants. We cannot source whether or not it is a legal marijuana plant versus an illicit marijuana plant. There's no way for us to really get in there and regulate it, enforce the laws, or anything else. So we're impotent. And we knew that going in, that this was going to be a problem. Because there are a lot of loopholes. And, you know, it continues to be a challenge.
Listen, I recognize the fact that, yes, the illicit market continues to thrive. We can look at California. Great example. 70% of the counties in California don't allow the commercial sale of cannabis. Okay, so yes, the illicit market continues to thrive there. At the same time, in 2023, California sold $20 billion worth of legal cannabis products and brought in over $1 billion in tax revenue. And I constantly hear that California is a failure story. I think that what we can look at,
well, it's a failure. It's a failure story because they're not dealing with water rights issues. They're not dealing with the runoff issue with the fertilization of that plant. They're not dealing with some of the other ecological challenges that are presented as a result of the growing and cultivation of marijuana. And anyone in California will tell you that. In fact, they haven't even put a number on what it would take to resolve the ecological challenges that have been created by the archaic way that most folks are growing, not necessarily the legal marijuana, but the downstream implication of the illicit industry comes right along with it.
You've seen, let's be honest here. California has been the quote-unquote homeland for cannabis for 60 years. People have been consuming California cannabis all over this country since the 70s, 80s, 90s. This is nothing new. Can we agree on that?
No, yeah, I would agree.
So I don't think that the proliferation of illegal cannabis grows has exponentially grown since legalization. I think that the way
I disagree with that. The nature and the construct of the illicit marijuana industry has changed in a huge way, not maybe exponentially in number of growers, because the fact of the matter is these are being controlled by criminal organizations, DTOs, drug trafficking organizations, and cartels. So it's the nature of this, because they're looking for high volume, high production, high yield properties. They're driving up the price. They're going in areas and doing it. And California, you can read story after story after story. They have an absolute mess as it relates to the enforcement of same.
And so I think you would find
the whole nature of the illicit side of the industry has changed. It's more challenging. It's not the cottage. None of this.
Wholeheartedly supported in the crackdown, and Governor Newsom in California has very much increased enforcement against these illegal operations, specifically the criminal organizations do.
Absolutely, you're making my case, but I mean, we talk about the tax dollars created on one hand, but we're not talking about the tax expense that's created on the other. And, you know, we're not typically what you would do to talk about economic impact. You would subtract one from the other. Yeah, but we don't do it that way.
Let's flip this conversation for a second, Noel. Let's go to a state like Louisiana that is still a prohibitionist state. Okay. Mm-hmm. And we do have a medical program, which approximately 50,000 people participate. Mm-hmm. But according to the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, is that roughly 600,000 Louisianans have consumed cannabis in the last month. So we're going to say, let's just conservatively say 500,000 Louisianians are working with the illicit market. Okay.
Right.
Any social ills that is associated with cannabis use, we are already incurring, but yet there is no tax dollars to help offset that. And we still have 26 states where cannabis is illegal and adult use sales are not permitted. We look at whether or not these companies are profitable enough because of 280E of the tax code, which means that a vast majority of regular business expenses that every other business in America can write off in their taxes, cannabis businesses cannot. Okay, that is a huge thing that is stymieing the growth of the industry in places like California. But, you know, we look at places like Missouri, Montana, Arizona. These are not liberal left-wing states. These are conservative states that have adopted legalization. You have currently a Republican-led movement in Florida, Senator Joe Gruters, who used to be the head of the Florida GOP and led President Trump's campaign in Florida. You have Dan Laughlin in Pennsylvania, another he's a state senator as well.
But Kevin, I don't see this as a D and an R issue. I mean,
because we've gone way beyond that.
To me, this is a societal impact issue. And the reality is, going back to what you said about we already have embedded in our community and our society a certain cost structure as it relates to the illicit use of marijuana, right? Now, if that had a negative economic impact on you, where would you be relative to the passage of legalization of marijuana, knowing that most of the data shows that you're going to have a significant increase in the illicit drug activity and your cost structure goes up? From a business perspective, as a business owner, you would say, no, I would have to be against that policy, because if the cost to my business are going to go up, because I know that in every state it's been implemented, the illicit use goes up, the illicit purchase goes up and use goes up, and I'm going to have to deal with the byproduct the same. I have to quantify this as to whether or not this makes any sense to me, because status quo may be better for me. And I think that's the question government leaders... Well, let me finish. I think that's the question that government leaders have to ask themselves today. Is when we go to the balance sheet, is this net-net a good deal for us, knowing that we are underfunding the treatment of the illicit use of drugs today? And that doesn't even quantify, and I know everybody says that marijuana is not a gateway drug. I disagree with that premise as well, because that wouldn't bode well for the proponents of legalization. We don't even account for that.
And can I answer that?
Yes, Noel? Go ahead.
Repeated studies have shown between 47% and 52% of the United States has tried cannabis. Okay. But yet only 10% have tried cocaine. Mm-hmm. 4% have tried heroin or methamphetamine. Psychedelics, it's even lower. I think it's 2 or 3%. So if cannabis was truly a gateway drug, would those numbers not be much higher?
Well, again,
those are numbers from the federal government.
Yeah, but again, you're not taking into account the genetically the genetic impact or what they've done through genetics as to making the marijuana that we all knew in the 70s much different in its presentation today. I mean, you know, I was looking at a study yesterday on dabbing. You're talking about 91% THC levels in this stuff. They don't need to move over there. So the delay in moving to these other drugs is for a bigger high, or stronger high, a longer high. They don't. It's not required as of yet because of the genetically altered cannabis plants that have gone on over the last 10 years. And as this industry matures even more, you're going to see more and more and more of this. So you can't just discount what's actually happening out there and the motivation to move to those other drugs. We've just delayed it.
In the 1970s, Newell, we had hash. We had tie stick. Yes, the quote-unquote brick weed, as they used to call it, that was very prevalent in the 70s, yes, was a very lower THC level than what you see today. I think prohibition creates stronger cannabis, not the legal market. And that's the beautiful thing about being the laboratories of democracy that states are. A, no state that has adopted legalization has moved to criminalize it again. And if they see a problem with, like, for example, you mentioned dabbing. And the New Frontiers Data Center estimates about 7% of the market uses dabs as a method of delivery. That includes medical patients, okay, mm-hmm. not just adult use. But states can decide to limit availability of products that they see a problem with. And I just think that
in the legal supply chain, they can. They've been reluctant and they've been late. In Colorado, you can buy dabbing products in the stores.
You can in our medical program.
You know, you can in the medical program as well. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, we moved this conversation from cannabinoids and the medical research on cannabinoids into the THC realm real quick, because it was never about the THC. I know I was in those testimonies before the state legislature.
I remember and, I was there with,
and, you know, and I remind and I reminded every one of y'all, watch how fast THC goes up in all of these products if it's not strictly regulated, because it's all about the THC. It ain't about the cannabinoid. We can talk about that, and no one will ever get me to believe it, because the predominant conversation right now across this country is not the health and welfare that is provided by cannabinoid research. It's all about THC. We're not genetically altering plants to get more cannabinoid. We're genetically altering them to get more THC. That speaks volumes. That tells me exactly what the intent was all along. Kevin, I look forward to getting you on again. We've run out of time. Kevin Caldwell, Southeast Legislative Manager for the Marijuana Policy Project. Always enjoy the conversation with you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Newell.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Take me out to the ball game.
What are you doing?
Did you know DirecTV has the most MLB games?
So you're singing?
Yeah, they put your favorite teams front and center right when you turn it on. Buy me some cold cuts and flapjacks.
Those aren't even the words.
I'm allergic to peanuts.
Stream DirecTV, home of the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks. RSNs available with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed's sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a five-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or whenever my favorite team is playing late. Five-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Stephanie Turner, Senior Vice President of Convention Sales and Strategies at New Orleans and Company. We're going to talk about a number of things in the aftermath of a very busy three-month season that we're coming off of. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Noel. Thanks for having me.
So, Stephanie, in the aftermath of Taylor Swift, Sugar Bowl, Super Bowl, Mardi Gras, we're now moving to another stage, the festival season. Things seem to be going really strong.
It's been an incredible year amidst so many things that have happened to us, starting with the tragedy of the terrorist attack and then great solidarity by our community to come together and our country in supporting us and our customers as well. So, you know, I was just at a meeting this morning with a lot of folks from our industry and said, this is in some ways the longest quarter I've ever been through. It's hard to believe it's, you know, the middle of March, all the things we've done here in New Orleans quite successfully.
Absolutely. You know, and right after every one of these events, we had like fairly large groups of people coming to the city.
We do. And you know, I'll use today as a great example. Today, just following Mardi Gras, we have two significant groups in. And this is one I think people don't think about is all the youth sporting events we do. We have 22,000 10 to 18-year-olds, mostly girls here, 650 teams from 32 states competing in the Nike Music City Championship. And, you know, we won that event from a competitor city a couple years ago. And so while they're here, we've got 6,000 folks here from Student Affairs and Higher Education. So if you happen to go by the convention center or any of the hotels, it's extraordinarily busy. And you think of a period following Mardi Gras that it would be, like you said, a bit of a break between Super Bowl and, you know, our next big of festival season. But in fact, actually, the day after Super Bowl, we had the Center for Literacy and Learning check in with 3,000 people. And then right after Mardi Gras, we had school superintendents literally building out their exhibition on Mardi Gras Day and checking in. So, you know, we provide that consistency of business for our community, for our restaurants, for our venues, for our, you know, folks that all work in the hospitality industry that really create continuity for our businesses. And we're very proud of that work.
You piqued my curiosity about this Music City thing. What is that convention about?
It's a volleyball competition.
Oh, it's a volleyball.
It's volleyball. Sorry I left that out. Yes, there are 23,000 mostly girls from 10 to 18 years old. So I guess our message would be to all of our friends around the convention center and hotels, have lots of chicken fingers. They are young and they are hungry and they're competing.
And they play good volleyball.
I happened to be at a volleyball tournament this past weekend, and it's amazing, you know, how well. And I mean, pure athletes. Totally enjoyed it.
It is. They are very athletic. You know, Nike's a sponsor, and it says a lot about the, you know, the importance of youth sports and the appeal of this competition. They sold out, and we're very proud to host teams from 32 of our states here in New Orleans.
How long will they be in town, Stephanie?
Just a couple days. They're going to be wrapping up this weekend. They're here the 15th through the 17th.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also at the Hilton, you know, right down the street.
Right. And I was looking at one of the reports that you have about, you know, the number of peak rooms with each one of these convention centers, at the convention center. And it's really important to get a good diverse mix of small, medium, and large, right?
It is. Our city's a bit different than a lot of the cities we compete with. By nature of where we have two Fortune 500s in our state, we don't do the amount of individual business travel, people going to travel to their regional office that happens in other cities. And so what we do in convention sales and services is we build the foundation. So we're not only looking at today, we're looking at into 2030 and 2040 and looking at multiple different size groups. That creates what we call compression. It creates a volume of visitors. So then when we do have events like Jazz Fest coming or French Quarter Fest, our convention calendar, because not only is it important for our convention calendar to fill the convention center, we have 26,000 hotel rooms downtown at all different locations from the convention center. So the importance of in-hotel meetings that our team books here at New Orleans and Company and our hotel partners, you know, we book half of what we do in the convention center and half in the hotels. And that's very important because the further you get away from the convention center, the least affected you are by some of those conventions, even into the French Quarter or into the areas downtown in the CBD. So it's very important for the community for us to look at all of those sizes of meetings, from 10 rooms to something like we just hosted, like the Super Bowl, which absolutely takes up every room in the city.
Yeah, and they're so dynamic, right? I mean, my experience just with the Super Bowl, and I hadn't been on Media Row the previous one, but everyone says, oh, my God, it's doubling in size, and it's so different. And I got to imagine it's the same with a lot of these conventions that do come back year after year.
They do, and they change, and the dynamics of their membership changes, the age of their membership, the value of what they're educating, what their education provides. And just like our broader economy benefits or maybe retracts from what's happening from technology to innovation, these conferences have the same impact. And so you'll see, like, for example, I mean, cancer research is a tremendous topic with meetings of all different kinds all over the country. And as money is put into cancer research or other fields, then it draws people from all over the broader economy, whether it be someone that's developing a new drug or educators or doctors who are looking for new treatments. So it really, the meetings industry does respond very much to what's happening in the country and in the world in terms of topics and technology and how things are growing and becoming more important.
Absolutely. What do you see? I know we've talked about this a couple of times, but you're out there competing in a very competitive arena. What's our biggest challenge from a story perspective about what we say about ourselves?
That's a great question. And I think that many destinations, you know, we, because there's so much more competition, that is 18 convention center projects around the country in various phases, like Dallas is closed now, and you see all these things. So I think that, you know, for us competitively, From my career in this industry, what happens around the country matters. You saw, you know, a period of time where legislative issues impacted where people wanted to go or not go. One customer said to me last week, I just want to go back to being able to book meetings, and that's it. So I think for New Orleans, it's very important for us to remain fresh and to continue to see growth and innovation happening, putting ourselves in the national spotlight really successfully like we did with Super Bowl is very important. seeing new projects like the Omni come on is very important, because our competitors have so much new new products coming on, new hotels. You know, we've all talked about, you and I have talked about Nashville. Nashville and New York are bringing on more hotel product than any other city again this year. And so fresh and new is really important. What we've done to emerge in New Orleans, what we've done so successfully in crime and safety and preparation for the Super Bowl, is benefiting us. That was very important. Our customers, in the age of technology and in the age of 24-hour news cycles, they watch what's happening in every city they're meeting in, because their attendees respond. So if something happens, from a crime perspective, from a weather perspective, from a legislative perspective, they're not just calling New Orleans, they're calling their other cities. So we all as destinations have to be hyper aware of what's happening in our communities. And something that we say around this building is we have responsibility sometimes where we don't have authority. We have to be well-versed, and we have to participate in what's happening to make our city a better place to live, work, and visit. And I think that's why the work being done, you know, Walt Leger very well, Kevin Ferguson, you know, our whole executive team, to strengthen that message.
Let's do this, if you don't mind. Let's get to a break. We'll come back for your final thoughts, because I do have a couple of questions I want to ask you. We're visiting with Stephanie Turner, Senior Vice President of Convention Sales and Strategies at New Orleans & Company. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Stephanie Turner, Senior Vice President of Convention Sales and Strategies at New Orleans & Company. There was something you said, Stephanie, and it kind of brought something to light for me. We were talking about these large conventions, medium-sized, small conventions, but they all kind of desire the same thing, right? They like a clean city. They like the way that a city presents itself and such. Are we truly all on the same page as to how important that is for us here? I mean, I know we went through a big, big exercise for Super Bowl, and I know there's
a
deep desire that we continue it on. But I was just interviewed the Inspector General, Ed Michelle, and in the streetlight department, they have two employees. Literally impossible to be able to, manage the streetlights. Not enough people. It's those kind of things that people see and recognize, right?
Well, I think we are, and I think it's important to say that. And our department here at Convention Sales and Services, we're working with entities and government and all the industry to make a convention successful. No one thinks about the coordination on the face of it to run a shuttle service for a major citywide. But we do that successfully day in and day out. And I think the testament, and look, let me just say that every city has challenges, and I don't want to pretend that we don't or gloss them over. But what we do extraordinarily well is work together, and you hear folks around town loving to say that we're built to host, and I'm incredibly proud of that. But what's important about that is it's true. What our competitive advantage is our people and the ability to love to host and genuinely host. So when I look at over 320 conventions that our teams brought to the city this quarter alone, and, you know, the great majority of them extremely successful, I would be naive to say that we weren't successful as a destination if we couldn't pull that off. And I think that's the bigger thing for me, is we're really good at it day in and day out.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us, Stephanie Turner. We really appreciate it, and have a great weekend.
Always great to be with you. Thanks for having me, Newell.
Thank you. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. We'll talk about the reappointment of the Inspector General Ed Michelle. We'll talk about Operation Sideswipe and some other issues as well. So stay tuned.
Think warm. Think palm trees. Think baseball. Hi, I'm MLB.com's Matt Monaghan. The long, dark freeze is over, and spring training is finally here. If you're a baseball fan looking for a quick, easy way to get all the scores, top stories, and best sound bites from Florida and Arizona, you're in luck.
I don't think people realize how good we are. I don't even know if we realize how good.
The Morning Lineup Podcast, a short, less than 10-minute baseball highlight show, is available anywhere on any platform you listen to podcasts on, 5 days a week. We can't wait to meet you there.